This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. It's hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. It has been estimated that something like 10 to 15% of all medical diagnoses are incorrect. And there are some people who have studied this issue who think that, in fact, the number might even be higher than that. Most people think, as they think about medical errors, think, well, that must be due to technical mistakes. It must be mistakes in reading test results or in carrying them out or in the way that equipment is used, something like that. However, that's really not the case. This is not about technical errors. It is about flaws in the way that doctors think. And that is our topic for this part of the show, what it is that goes on in a doctor's mind when he or she treats a patient, how that perhaps is a result of the way that they're trained, and how that might need to change so that diagnosis and communication between the patient and the doctor can be improved. And that is the subject of a book that we'll be talking about in this part of Focus 580. The title of the book is How Doctors Think. It has been recently published by Houghton Mifflin, and the author of the book is our guest this morning, Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, has written many scientific articles. He's also written pieces that have appeared in New Republic, Washington Post, New York Times. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has written several other books as well, including The Anatomy of Hope, Second Opinions, and The Measure of Our Days. As we talk this morning with Dr. Groopman, your questions certainly are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to, you know, be brief so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving along. But anyone who is listening this morning is welcome to call. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455 and locally 333-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, you can give us a call, participate in the conversation. Well, Dr. Groopman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
There are many examples that one could give in the book. I was thinking maybe as a story to start with, we might start with the story of the forest ranger. That's also one that it's in this book, and it's in a piece that you wrote for The New Yorker. And here's a case where you had a man who was having chest pains, was concerned enough about this to go to the doctor. So he goes to the doctor, and the doctor looks at him. He appears to be healthy. He's physically active. He doesn't have any of the common risk factors for heart disease. He seems to be fine. So the doctor says, well, you know, maybe what you did is you strained a muscle. Don't worry about it. The guy, and he sends the guy away. Then the doctor comes into work the next day. One of his colleagues says, you know, I saw that fellow that you saw here yesterday. He was back here. He had a heart attack. And I'm sure the doctor was just horrified, thinking, oh, my God, how could I possibly have missed that? But it does go to a number of central points that you write about. And particularly it has to do with, you know, the way things look on the surface. Maybe that's not the way that it is. But how do you get doctors to go beyond the surface?
Well, that's a very powerful story. And what makes it even more instructive is that the emergency room physician who saw that forest ranger up in Halifax, Nova Scotia, that ER doctor was originally trained as a psychologist and has actually become interested in how doctors think. And yet he was susceptible to this kind of error in thinking. What he did was too quickly superimpose his initial impression of this robust, healthy ranger onto the template of a heart attack victim, a person who smokes or is obese or, you know, has had prior angina, and in fact said to the forest ranger, I have zero suspicion that this is coming from your heart. Mm-hmm. Instead of being prudent and thinking, well, maybe he doesn't correspond to the template. Maybe he's not a typical case. and keeping him there for observation, repeating the blood tests, and indeed finding that he was in the middle of a blockage of his coronary artery. And in terms of what to do about it, you know, I think there are really two approaches. One has to do with the doctor, and the other has to do with the patient and the patient's family.
Hmm. Well, I suppose one might say that the way the doctors are trying to do the diagnosis, and you say maybe we ought to look at how it is the doctors in medical school are trained to think, and then also how what happens in real practice. I think one would say, well, maybe if in fact those figures that I cited about 10 to 15%, maybe more of all medical diagnoses are wrong. Let's take the low end. So maybe it's 10%. That would say to you that the way that we are doing diagnosis 90% of the time works okay. So then I guess that then goes to this question of if most of the time that works fine, then what do you do to get physicians to consider the fact that it might be one of those 10% of the cases where the way that we're doing the diagnosis doesn't work, and then go from that to perhaps asking other questions or considering that there could be something else going on here, less common, but something that is a real problem and something that we might miss?
Well, I agree that generally we do a good job. Now, remember that those kinds of statistics encompass everyone, you know, going in with a sore throat and being told it's a virus or it's not a virus, it's strep, things like that. When we most need a doctor to make the diagnosis is when our symptoms are vague or when we, as you say, don't fit the typical picture. And in medical school, we're not taught how to think with regard to checking ourselves and knowing how the mind works and how we as doctors think. The way we think is very much like that forest ranger. We think by what's called pattern recognition. We look at what's in front of us, the story from the patient, the physical examination, the laboratory test, and we superimpose it on a typical template. We're also working with limited information often and under tremendous time pressure, particularly in today's medical environment of managed care. So we use shortcuts. One of the shortcuts we use is called an anchoring mechanism. We sort of immediately throw our mental anchor. We latch on to our first impression. And unfortunately, we get stuck there too often, and we don't consider a key question, which is, what else could it be? Or is this not a typical case? There are many other kinds of errors and stories that I write about in the book. To my knowledge, no one has ever really put together a framework for a lay audience about the kinds of mistakes and thinking we make as physicians and how we can remedy that. And part of it, as I said, involves us learning how our minds work as doctors. And also, I believe very strongly that you, as a patient or a family member or friend, should know how my mind works as a physician. And that knowledge will assist you in preventing me from making a mistake.
Mm-hmm. So you think that better communication both ways can make a difference, and that patients in the way that they talk to the doctor, is it a matter of the way that they try to explain what it is that they are experiencing that can make a difference?
Well, that is helpful. I mean, it's really the doctor's job to try to encourage this patient to, first of all, tell his or her entire story. There are studies that show that these days, on average, physicians interrupt a patient within 18 seconds of the patient beginning to describe what's wrong. That 18-second mark frequently represents the physician coming to a snap judgment. It may be the fourth or fifth thing that the patient wanted to talk about that proves to be the key clue in the diagnosis. All too often, we as physicians grab onto that first bit of information and anchor onto it. So communication is very important, but it's more than communication. It's knowing these shortcuts, these mental shortcuts that all of us use when we're working under time pressure and we're dealing with uncertainty. And those are the conditions of clinical medicine, time pressure and uncertainty. And by asking appropriate constructive questions, the patient or family member can help prevent us from falling into a thinking trap. They can ask, what else could it be when we offer a diagnosis? If their symptoms are not going away or have only partly gone away, they can say, are two things going on at the same time? Could I have two diagnoses? Sometimes lightning strikes twice. In medical school, we're not taught to think that way. We're taught to come up with a single diagnosis. They can also ask a very important question, and that is there anything that you found which seems to contradict your assumption about my diagnosis? Because we almost subconsciously tend to focus on information that confirms our assumption, and we can subconsciously discount information that contradicts our impression.
Let me introduce again our guest, and then we have a caller we want to bring into the conversation. Dr. Jerome Groopman is professor of medicine at Harvard Med School. He's also chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He is also a staff writer at The New Yorker and has a number of articles for both popular press and for the scientific press. His most recent book explores this area that here we're talking about this morning. The title of the book is very clear. It says what it is. It's How Doctors Think. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, in which he takes a look at the kind of research that has been done about how doctors do diagnosis. He spent time talking with a number of physicians about how they approach the problem, particularly physicians who have done a misdiagnosis and then afterwards have tried to go back and look and ask the question, well, what happened here? How did I come to the wrong conclusion? The idea is that it is both a book that could help doctors in making better diagnosis, but also in help patients perhaps either ask questions of their doctors or provide better information or, in a sense, help the doctor make a better diagnosis. So the book is out there in the bookstores now. You might want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go ahead and talk with the caller here. We have someone in Urbana, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hello. Distinct privilege to talk to you, doctor. I read your book, and I passed around the New York Review of Books review of your book to friends of mine, and you are right on the money here. I mean, I would have never thought this until about 3 years ago. I developed these weird headaches, and I went to the physicians, and they'd look at you like, mm-hmm. And then I realized they didn't really know it was wrong. They still don't, as a matter of fact. And it's just amazing when you walk. I can go into a physician now, and after reading your book, I look at them and I think, well, what don't they know about me? How do I talk to them? I mean, without, you know, because they have an air of, you know, well, I'm an MD, and I know more than you'll ever know, so don't talk to me. And but it's very interesting. Your book is fascinating because you do point out the fact that it's not what your doctor knows, it's what they don't know. And I think patients are afraid of that. So,
well, I think that's a very important point. There are two points you make. One is that, and these are mistakes that I've made and have learned the hard way, is that very often when someone comes in with complaints that are not easy to diagnose or there's not a clear cause, the physician begins to take a negative attitude towards the patient and really close his or her mind off.
You're right. I mean, I'll say one thing. I was given a medicine about a month ago, and I had a psychotic episode. I called the doctor and said, look, I thought I was going nuts. And he goes, well, just cut it in half. I thought, what the hell are you talking about? So I did have an appointment to see him a week later, and I looked at him, and I thought, I looked at this guy and I thought, were you just crazy? This guy, I don't understand this guy. I mean, I just looked at him and I said, you know, you don't understand. I went kind of nuts. And he's like, well, you didn't take the medicine? I go, no. I mean, I wanted to say this. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just could not believe this guy. Yeah, I'm sorry, but I just, you know, wanted to, I'm very frustrated with these people. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I can, you know, compare war stories. I mean, I had a back injury, and someone gave me, you know, in good intentions, a medication for the pain, the nerve pain from an accident I had, and I started hallucinating from the medication. These medications are extremely powerful, and I didn't take another pill because I'm not interested in being hallucinating and having hallucinations. But I think the key is that, you know, all of us, and again, the worst errors in this book are my own, as you know from having read it, is that, you know, a lot of us as physicians are don't like to fail or don't like to feel that we don't have answers. And sometimes the best thing a physician can say is, I don't know. And to keep digging, or to send the person to another physician who either in the same specialty or a different discipline, and hopefully keep looking until there can be a helpful explanation.
Yeah, and I agree. But I wanted to interject one thing, and I want to hang up because I know other people are waiting, but the TV show House, where you see this incredibly arrogant doctor, but he always solves the problem. And I think in a way the popularity of that show is because people have been going to doctors for years, I'm not, you know, alluding to myself or anything, and getting nothing from them, and i.e. a solution to their problem. And I know some of these are psychotic, and I know all that stuff, but I want to thank you. I really want to thank you for your book. It is a very important piece of literature, and it should be, you know, I passed it around to friends, and I've told friends to buy it, and I think everybody needs to read your book. I mean, because at one point in their life, they're going to walk into a doctor's office and meet somebody that's not going to help them. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Other folks who are listening are certainly welcome. If you have questions or comments, would like to talk with our guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think that perhaps the caller gives the opportunity to ask this question about what happens when the doctor-patient relationship goes wrong, at least from the perspective of the patient. If you feel that your doctor doesn't respect you, doesn't like you, if there's friction, it sounds as if your suggestion would be find yourself another doctor.
Well, it's interesting. You know, there's a team, Deborah Roeder at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore and Judy Hall up here in Boston at Northeastern University. They've studied this. They've looked at thousands and thousands of doctor-patient interactions and show that two things. One is that when a physician does have negative feelings about a patient, that causes him or her to close off their mind, often prematurely, to stop thinking about what's wrong. But what's interesting is most patients blame themselves. They think it's their fault that the doctor doesn't like them. And there are two things here. One is that I think if a patient is feeling some sort of negative sense from the physician, and, you know, physicians can have bad days or become irritated or whatever, it's perfectly appropriate to say, you know, I don't sense that we're connecting well. I don't sense we're communicating well. And most doctors want to be, communicating well. They want to do the right thing. And that will stop us and get us back on track. But when I asked other physicians if they were patients and they felt a negative attitude from their doctor, every physician I spoke to told me that he or she would find another doctor.
I'm sure that physicians, depending upon what their area of practice is, what part of the country they're in, what kind of, you know, what typically the kind of people that they see, there will be certain conditions, certain diseases that they might see a lot or it might see frequently. And then there might be some things that they learned about in med school that they could go years and never see at all, never see a single case of that. And that seems that that's part of the problem, that is that I know it's the old saw. Doctors have actually said it on my own show, and I've heard doctors say the thing about, you know, when you hear hoofbeats, you don't look up expecting to see a zebra. Mm-hmm. You expect to see the things that you have seen before. And in a sense, I suppose I keep asking the same question, but how it is that you get doctors to consider the possibility that a patient could be before them, and they could indeed have something that doctor might have learned about once, but that this could be the first time ever in their practice that they'd seen it.
Well, there are two things there. One is that you need to think in your mind the way one of the doctors I profile in the book, a woman who's a specialist in endocrinology, hormones, and metabolism named Karen Delgado, and she plays a game. And she says, okay, this is what the diagnosis seems to be. Okay, these are the hoofbeats. Mm-hmm. It's a horse. What if it's a zebra? And then she says, can I rearrange the pieces of this puzzle, the findings from the patient's story, the physical examination, the laboratory tests, the x-rays, into a different picture? And that's important, particularly if the person is not getting better, if the medication is not working, and so on. And the other is a mistaken thinking, a so-called cognitive trap, which is called availability, which is very much speaks to what you just said, and that is that we tend to summon in our thinking those things that are most familiar and immediate to us. So one of the stories I tell in the book is of a emergency room doctor on a Navajo reservation in Arizona in the middle of a flu epidemic. So he's seen 20, 30 people on the reservation with flu. So, you know, the 31st person who comes in saying that she had a little fever and she's breathing quickly, he immediately thinks it's flu. But it turns out that even though her findings on physical exam and chest x-ray were not consistent with flu, he's still stuck with flu, because that was what was available in his mind. And it turned out that, mistakenly, she had taken an overdose of aspirin, which is a very serious problem. And the reason she was breathing quickly and having all of these symptoms was because she was being poisoned by aspirin. And luckily, another physician made the correct diagnosis. So you need to know that, yes, it's usually a horse, but sometimes a zebra does come galloping in.
We have some other folks to talk with. Let's do that. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. We've actually already have your book, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I saw it in the New York Times list, and I thought, I got to get this. One thing I wanted to just to ask about a little bit was, one of my problems has been, I have a very close friend who has had a physical problem, and I went with a friend to a Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, and one thing I noticed was, I actually studied Japan, so the person's Japanese also, one thing I noticed that was that American surgeons, or at least this was the case in Mayo also, is that we would talk to a surgeon, and then we would talk to, I don't know, doctors, other oncologists and others and so on, and the surgeon would always want to cut. But it was all invariably, and the other doctors were quite clear about this, that the surgeons would, you know, tend to want to, do surgery first before, you know, trying other options and so on. And my experience in Japan and so on is never like that, and I thought that was very interesting. The other thing is I just, my mother's elderly, and I always try to have my sister go with her because I know my mother will never ask good questions or ask anything of the doctor because I think she kind of sees the doctor as some kind of god. The more questions, the better. One other thing is, would you agree with this, that I have a friend who's a doctor who said that you should always go to the doctor through a referral, always go to the referral, in part because you'll always be treated as a name rather than a number? That your treatment will, in other words, if you have the direct referral rather than simply, you know, choosing a doctor from some list and showing up at the door, in a sense, that the treatment will be perhaps more careful or something like that.
Well, there are several parts to your question.
Right,
so the,
yeah.
the first one, and there's is a chapter in the book on surgery, is that, yes, you know, surgeons like to operate. That's why they became surgeons. But the best surgeons are the ones who operate when they have a very clear idea of what's wrong. And I actually had an accident trauma to my wrist, and I saw six different hand surgeons and got four completely different opinions. And it took 2 years to figure out what was the problem, and only then was it really prudent to operate.
Right.
So I think that operating can be life-saving and restoring people,
right,
and so on, but you have to have a very strong sense of confidence that the surgeon has a good idea of what he or she is going to find when they put the scalpel to the skin. With regard to your mother, I mean, I also come from a culture where, Eastern European Jews, where physicians are sort of worshipped and basically authority figures and not questioned. And I think that very much now, and this is one of the points of the book, yes, a doctor has much more education and learning and so on, but we are not God. We are fallible. We make mistakes. And our minds actually worked in ways that can sometimes trick us, so that you want a physician to bring to bear all of his experience and knowledge and education, but you also want to partner with him or her. And the way you do that most effectively is by knowing how doctors think and how they think successfully and when they sometimes go astray.
Well, thanks for the call.
Great, thanks.
We appreciate it. This gives me an opportunity maybe to ask I'm getting on to some other callers here in a moment, but ask another question, one of the things that you explore in the book, and that is, do different kinds of doctors, and by that we mean comparing family practice doctors, surgeons, pediatricians, people who work in other particular areas, do different kinds of doctors think differently as a group? That is not one individual compared to another, but depending upon their specialty or their area of practice.
Well, there are generalities. All of us as physicians, regardless of our specialty or type of practice, do have the same kinds of thinking patterns, using these shortcuts, these anchoring and so on. But on the other hand, each one is different. The hardest job, I believe, is the primary care doctor and the pediatrician and the general internist, because by and large, the kids who are coming into the pediatrician or the adults coming in to see the primary care doc, most of them don't have anything serious. They have a cold or sniffles or some problem that brings them there, but you have to keep your eyes open and be able to pick out that one kid with the fever who has meningitis, or that one adult who has vague discomfort under the breastbone, and it's not indigestion, but it's a heart attack. And that is incredibly difficult. Most of the patients who come to see me as a specialist, I already know they're very ill because I take care of people with cancer and blood diseases. So my challenge is the nuances of the treatment of lymphoma, leukemia, or breast cancer. But the really different kind of thinking involves the primary care doctor, who has to pick out that one sick individual and also know how many tests to do to get quickly to the pivot point between who is really ill and who isn't.
Let's continue. We'll talk with someone next in Kankakee on our line 4. This is the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, doctor. And I can relate to the earlier caller who was very frustrated. And I have a situation where I feel I've been sort of profiled in pain clinics. And I've gone to different pain clinics and been offered redundant procedures that weren't effective before. And when I've explained to doctors, yeah, I've used this drug and I've tried that and I've had this procedure and that procedure. I injured my spine. I broke my back. And I don't feel like I'm getting a fair shake with regards to, addressing pain. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, it's like I've been, victimized by physicians using these types of shortcuts.
Well, there are two responses I have. One is that I also had an accident, a very bad accident with my back, and actually re-injured it. And so I know firsthand what it's like to have really significant daily pain. There are two things. One is, you use the word profiling. That's a very appropriate word. Everyone has stereotypes in his or her mind. And all too often, physicians will stereotype or profile a patient. often it's a woman, and she's in the middle of menopause. So they think that every problem, every complaint can be attributed to change of life, to menopause. In terms of people who have had accidents and have pain, unfortunately, some physicians profile these patients as being malingerers or slackers. And I can tell you, having had back pain, it's hardly malingering and being a slacker. It's quite awful. And then the point you make, which is a very true one, is that some problems are very tough and you have to sort of think out of the box. And one of the almost counterintuitive aspects to pain management is this new biology where you actually have to use the injured area to create new circuits in the spinal cord and brain that are positive, healthy circuits that damp down the unrelenting pain circuits. But all too often as doctors, we just keep doing the same thing. We all prescribe the same medications, whether it's Neurontin or Lyrica or whatever. We'll offer the same cortisone injections, and even though they haven't worked in the past, because a lot of physicians don't feel they have anything else to offer. So what I think and what I did in my own case, and I write about this in my writing, is I actually found a rehabilitation physician who took this different approach, and it was tremendously beneficial. It wasn't a cure-all, but it definitely helped damp down the pain and made me more functional.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's a regulatory backlash. I mean, my issue has really come down to multiple spinal fusions or a modest use of opiates. So opiates, I could get back to work, I think at least part-time, and that would improve my situation more than any single act. And I feel there's a hypocrisy or a fear of regulation from, you know, the FDA or whoever is, you know, oversees these things with doctors. And I don't have an established relationship with my family doctor who knows me personally. You know, I'm not at risk to physical addiction to those drugs, and it seems like the risks are overstated. And I don't know. I'm very frustrated.
Well, it is true that a lot of physicians worry about risks of addiction. But as you say, addiction really occurs in people who have addictive personalities. And the vast majority of people who have pain syndromes can be very, very safely given pain medication without the risk of addiction. So I think
most people,
I don't want to be your doctor on the phone here, and I'm careful of doing that. But I think that the best thing to do is to find a physician who really gets to know you, not only your physical problem and the accident and injury you had, but also you as an individual, and then establish a relationship that can lead to the right kinds of therapy.
So walking into a pain clinic, which I've done twice, and had some, you know, pretty bad experiences. You know, one guy literally tried to sell me an inappropriate surgery on every visit. And when I declined, ultimately, after going to him for 3 months and taking a lot of inexpensive drugs, which I had taken before, he just cut me loose rather than, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of debate, as you probably know. There is, and I actually write about this in How Doctors Think, there's been just a huge increase in the number of spinal fusions. They're very useful for people who have dislocated vertebra. Those represent about 1 to 2% of all people with chronic back pain. It's a tiny, tiny fraction.
And it's a bad move for me.
No. Listen, I'm just saying that the vast majority of fusions, and this has been looked at by Richard Deo at the University of Washington, are being done without clear rationale. So, you know, there are these fads or these movements with regard to different treatments or surgical procedures, which really are not supported by scientific evidence.
Well, you know, you've got to make your own decision. I mean, personally, I did some homework. I talked to different doctors. A surgeon told me that if he were me, he wouldn't do it. Okay. And that made me think about my situation. I did a lot of work on it. And then I'm in pain clinics and hospitals, and I'm seeing all these people with spinal fusion. And I sat in a waiting room with 25 people who had spinal fusions. It was the House of Horrors. I mean, these people were, to a person, regretted having the surgery. Now, granted, I'm sitting in a pain clinic, so you're there with people who have problems. But I've only met one person who had a spinal fusion who told me that they would have had it.
Well, there was a study done in Sweden that supports your impression. It did not show that spinal fusions at 2 years had afforded any greater benefit to patients with injuries and low back pain versus physical therapy and conservative measures.
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have several other people who are holding, and we just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And also, for the benefit of anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 minutes, I want to introduce again our guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He's also a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, has authored several editorials on policy issues in New Republic, Washington Post, New York Times. He is the author of a book that explores this area that we're talking about here this morning. That is, the way the doctors think, what goes through their minds when they are talking to patients and trying to figure out what's wrong with them. The title of the book is How Doctors Think. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, a book that I'm sure would be helpful for physicians, but also for all of us to give us something to think about before we go to the doctor to try to understand better what they're thinking about, what the doctor is thinking about. And we have several people here with questions. We'll try to see if we can get everybody in the time that remains. Next person in line is in Urbana, I believe, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering whether your book talks about making decisions and communicating with doctors near someone, the end of someone's life. And I'm not talking about keeping somebody alive who's on machines. I think there's a slippery slope of decisions we end up needing to make. As for ourselves or as the person with power of attorney for someone not capable of making decisions anymore. And to illustrate this, there's been two family members, neither one who wanted to end up in a nursing home, but one of whom has dementia, not communicative at all, or very, very little. But she's been treated for colon cancer and then twice for pneumonia and has been in a dementia ward for 8 years and would have been, if she were in her right mind, she would be aghast that she's been essentially kept alive all this time. And her doctors have recommended the operation for colon cancer and then being treated for pneumonia. Another story is of another relative who had early dementia and developed pancreatic cancer. And we were fortunate to have a primary care physician who said, this man is elderly, he's late 80s, and I do not think that it would serve him well to have an operation. There is an operation. Talk to the physician, but understand that surgeons are aggressive doctors, and this is an aggressive surgeon. He's an excellent surgeon, but he's a very aggressive person. But talk to him, see what you think. That was very helpful to be armed with that. And he explained to the three of us what the procedure was. We didn't talk about any of the risks other than to say that there was a 20% survival rate and this was a good tumor. And I said to him, well, we're talking about a man who's in his late 80s, near the end of his life. And his doctor said that she does not think that he would do well with this procedure. Why is that? And it wasn't until I said that he said, and he made it sound real simple, and basically what they do is they cut three of your tubes apart and stitch them back together again and hope that nothing leaks or gets infected and have to move all kinds of body parts around. And it was then that he said, this makes multiple coronary bypass surgery look like a picnic.
Well, you make some very, very important points. First, there is a chapter devoted to this in the book, thinking through these kinds of issues, and it's called the chapter heading is called Science of the Soul, because you need to pay attention to what the person's quality of life and where they are in life and so on. And one of the most illustrative stories in that chapter is of a oncologist, an outstanding oncologist named Steven Nimer, who saw two patients who were relatively old with the identical disease and a serious blood disease, a fatal blood disease. And he treated each one differently based on what the social setting and the psychological setting and the beliefs and the values and so on of each individual within the context of his or her family. So that these kinds of aspects of decision-making are as important as any CAT scan or blood test or pathology diagnosis. And I do agree there too often is a response based on what the clinical diagnosis is, pancreatic tumor or colon cancer, versus placing it in the larger context of what's really best for that individual and what the quality of life is for that person.
Well, again, I appreciate the caller's call. I just have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple of other people holding. I want to try to get at least one more, and we'll go to line three, the next person in line right here. Hello.
Yeah, I'm actually a research psychologist. I primarily do statistics myself, but judgment, decision-making, heuristics, et cetera, are kind of a strong secondary interest of mine. And you're obviously drawing heavily on a lot of the literature that you're talking about. One point I just want to emphasize is this is something everybody does. It's not doctors. We all do this. And there's a very famous quote by the late Amos Tversky, who was one of the big developers of this field. And I don't know if I have it exact, but it's pretty close. For every cognitive error committed by a layman, there's a parallel, more sophisticated one committed by experts.
I appreciate this very much. There are two things. Both Tversky and Kahneman, who were originally psychologists at the Hebrew University, and Tversky died, as you know, at a young age, and Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in economics, did the seminal work. And what this book does is to look at that field. Medicine has incorporated a lot of different sciences, molecular biology and robotics and all of this high technology. What we failed to do is to incorporate your science, and that is real psychology and cognitive science, and particularly the science of Tversky and Kahneman. And as you said, it applies to all of us. And that's why, to me, it was such a revelation, because it explained my thinking and the errors that I made. And as you said, being a specialist and an expert, the kinds of errors I make are perhaps more specialized rather than the ones that are more general. But we have so much to learn from this new field that I think can really improve the way we as doctors make diagnoses and offer care.
Yeah, I guess the one other little follow-up I'll have is, since I started learning this stuff, I don't know exactly when it was a while ago, as a patient, I've really tried to pay attention to different doctors that I've dealt with over the years, and just try to diagnose as much as I can what I think their decision style is, and also how they relate to me, in the sense that, you know, think if they talk to me about quality of life issues, in the sense the doctor can't necessarily make those kinds of decisions for you. And if you're a patient who's looking for the doctor to, make these larger decisions of values for you, they really can't do that. And if someone is trying to do that, that's probably a bad sign.
Right. What a good doctor does, I agree with you entirely, is he opens up the conversation with you and wants to hear from you what your values are and how your beliefs and your needs and so on and your goals fit in to the current clinical situation. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think you're very fortunate in a way that you come from a background where you have this knowledge and this alertness to styles of decision-making. But I would argue that that, you know, I'm sure you're more sophisticated at doing it than myself or other people who are not trained this way, but a really good doctor should be able to explain his thinking or her thinking to a patient, and it should make sense. It should really make sense. A wonderful physician who taught me said that, you know, medicine is not rocket science. It's not quantum mechanics. It's anything that occurs in medicine can be understood if it's explained in a clear and logical way to a patient and a family member.
We're coming down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. One thing I'd like to have you talk a little bit about here is how here, obviously, what we've got here is a challenge to medical education, that perhaps what we ought to be doing is the way that doctors, young doctors, med students and young doctors are taught to do diagnosis and taught to think. That needs to change.
Absolutely. Much to my surprise, to some degree, and gratification, the book, I've gotten letters from deans of medical schools and medical educators around the country, very positive responses, talking about how this new science of thinking can be incorporated into medical education, and also medical education for physicians who are already established, you know, so-called continuing medical education. I think it's without it, there's a real gap in the way we're taught.
There obviously are other problems as well, perhaps institutional ones. I think that, for example, if you ask people what makes them unhappy about healthcare and the way that it's delivered, I'm sure that near the top of everyone's list is the feeling that they don't get to spend very much time with their physician and that the doctor doesn't really get much of a chance to know who they are, what's going on with them, and no doubt that creates the kind of pressure to, you know, to keep things moving, get people moving along, get them in and out, and puts pressure on the doctor to try to make a diagnosis and do it fairly quickly. That and other things, are there things that are outside the question of how doctors think, but that impinge on how doctors think that you could change if you could?
Absolutely. You know, you can't think well in haste. You can't communicate well when you're, you know, working against the stopwatch. And you also can't communicate well when you have one eye on the computer screen and the other on the wall clock, because you were told that you have to fill out some billing form and a template and get someone out of the office in 12 minutes to 14 minutes, which is literally what's going on now in many, many office settings. I would say two things. In the long run, there is such dissatisfaction. Physicians are very, very unhappy, feeling like they're working in a factory. And as you say, patients are even more unhappy, and rightfully so, that we need to argue that the system is lopsided and is not rewarding doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers for devoting time to patients. And time is what's needed to think well and communicate and also deal with the values issues and so on that the other caller brought up. The second, though, is because that won't change overnight, is that if you feel there's a problem that has not been explored deeply, if a diagnosis hasn't been arrived at, if you're not getting better and things are rushed, then a good physician can say, okay, you know, we really don't have the time to think this through today. Let's schedule another appointment in a few days or next week. I'll ponder it more. You think more about what's going on, and we'll reexamine it. Time is needed to think well and to deliver good care.
One other point, and unfortunately I can't get very, very much time to talk about it, but you do deal with it in the book, and that has to do with the proliferation of medications. And perhaps also the tendency to is there a tendency for doctors to somehow be influenced by the availability of medications to go in certain kinds of ways, to think in certain kinds of ways?
Absolutely. It's a push-pull. You know, most of the advertising dollars are now shifting to lay advertising, to patient-directed advertising on television and so on. Ask your doctor about this pill. Ask your doctor about that. And with the time constraints, where we're working under such time pressure, it becomes all too easy when a patient comes in and says, oh, you know, I saw an ad for this, or this looks good for me, and the doctor just writes the prescription and gives it to the patient. Because that seems to, you know, be what's demanded, even if that medicine is inappropriately expensive or may not even be the best thing for that person. And I deal with this in the book. In addition, physicians are unfortunately sometimes, you know, enticed with perks and gifts and things like that to sort of shift their thinking to prescribe in a certain way. And it's very, very, very important that we appreciate what the pharmaceutical industry does, which is to produce new treatments, many of which are really cures, like in my field in cancer. But at the same time, there is a movement to sell drugs, and many of these drugs are not better than what we already have, and they're much more expensive. Hmm.
Well, we are at the point here we're going to have to conclude. I certainly would suggest for people to take a look at the book. It's titled How Doctors Think. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. It's out recently by our guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's also chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and he's a staff writer at The New Yorker, so you can look for his writings from time to time in the magazine. Dr. Groopman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure to be with you today.